Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we'll be talking with Dr. Christopher Robertson, Associate Professor at the University of Arizona's Rogers School of Law, about prescription drug ads, the Food and Drug Administration, or the FDA, and informing your health.
This is really important, Christy, and I know you and I both feel that this is a difficult topic in how we communicate to patients in our office, much less the pharmaceutical companies communicating over the airwaves or in the newspapers, creates a lot of ethical concerns.
Yeah, ethical concerns and a lot of confusion for our patients. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about something called epigenetics and its relationship to smoking and heavy alcohol use.
We're going to talk about a lot of people who are depressed in the work site think, I'm not depressed.
About research that calls for stricter screening recommendations for people who have a family history of colon cancer.
And then finally, Christy and I are going to disclose our positive emotions. And does that make us healthier? Hopefully so.
I hope so, too. Okay, let's talk about this thing called epigenetics. So what we're talking about is gene expression and some complicated, it's hard to explain, but these patterns of something called DNA methylation, which is something that then affects how strongly a gene is expressed and how that is expressed.
You know, we had Dr. Cedar on, one of the world's foremost authorities on epigenetics, on our show a couple years ago, Christy from Hebrew University, and this is such an important field that's really up and coming, and it's here now where we can see how you might have a gene for something, but whether that gene ever turns on and you have the side effect. So for in this particular case, it's genes associated with aging and how smoking and alcohol use as external factors, these epigenetics can influence how these genes get expressed.
Yeah, and they found that these DNA methylation levels at two specific locations on these certain chromosomes was a better measure of substance use than people's self-reported estimates. So people might say, oh, I drink a beer a night or whatever they say, and that actually they were able to get a better measure of what was actually happening in substance use by doing these methylation levels, some test.
And they found that at all levels of exposure to cigarette smoke, that there were these really adverse effects with this methylation and associated with premature aging and moderate alcohol use. 1 to 2 drinks a day was the healthiest aging, but the kind of low and high consumption were accelerated aging. That goes with some of the data we know about too little or too much alcohol use, and there's no safe threshold for tobacco. But I think this is like the cutting edge of research that really matters, because it's going to start to show that you can predict these things probably at earlier ages, and I think patients can maybe hopefully benefit.
Right. And it would be neat to see then those methylation things change if you stop smoking or if you stop drinking or cut back on drinking, how that might change and how that might then slow down the aging process. You never know.
Kind of like that. Speaking of slowing down, people who are depressed at work really have, in addition to physical problems, there's concerns that the productivity at work goes down because there's so many things going on. And this is the next research that matters, is looking at this maybe undiagnosed depression in the workplace.
Right. And this was published in the Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine. And it was a study done in Ontario in Canada, where they found that a significant number of the workers, of people who work, were experiencing symptoms of depression and did not recognize that they could benefit from any help. So they're not seeking help, and maybe they don't want to miss work to go get help, or they don't realize they need it at all, but maybe they're missing work or less productive at work because they're not feeling well and certainly suffering maybe without really realizing that they could have help and feel better.
Yeah, over 2,000 Ontario adults filled out these surveys, and they were looking at kind of what blocks also them from getting the care, whether it was the stigma of mental illness, whether they didn't think that the treatment could be effective, whether there were financial problems. though hopefully some of the issues in Canada may even be better with some of the access to care wouldn't have to be as much costly as perhaps it is in the United States. And then perhaps a combination of all these barriers would really make it even more unlikely. So I think they're onto something here.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone needs to go get treatment when they're depressed, but this suggests to me there's a large reservoir in the workplace of depression that's not getting probably great care.
Right. And it may be that employers or that there may be health approaches within different work sites that can promote wellness and identify people who need help. This next one is about colon cancer screening. So you and I have talked many times, Adam, about colonoscopies and the benefits of colonoscopies. And hopefully our listeners have heard from us that if you're 50 or over, you should have your colonoscopy. But this is talking about potentially getting colon cancer screening at a much younger age if you have, and maybe more often, if you have a family history of colon cancer.
And we know from some of the guidelines that if you have a first-degree relative that got colon cancer at an early age, you should get your screening at even a much younger age. You know, you could be as young as 35 or even, you know. So, but the other question they looked at is, well, what if you have a relative, first-degree relative, that had colon cancer when they're like 80? You know, we wouldn't think, oh, well, that's a disease of aging. But it turns out it may well be. But for this particular person, your relative, your risk is still much higher. So at all ages, if you have a, you know, first-degree relative that's had colon cancer, you really need to pay attention and perhaps even do some things in your lifestyle that may have benefit. And we've talked about different things ranging from fiber to aspirin, different things that people could talk with their doctor about.
Right. So you may, if you're, no matter what age you are, but certainly maybe if you're in your 40s and you have any family history of colon cancer, talk to your doctor about if you should get that colonoscopy done earlier in your life.
And this was published in Clinical Gastroenterology and Hepatology. That's a mouthful to say, but
it is. Hepatology means liver.
Let's talk about our very last research that matters, and it's about positive emotions and heart healthy behaviors, which sounds great. I'm all for that.
It sounds fantastic. Okay, so what they did, this was published in the journal Psychosomatic Medicine, is that they followed over 5 years. They tracked more than 1,000 patients who already had heart disease. So they already had this coronary heart disease. And the patients who reported higher positive psychological states were more likely. So these are, they had to kind of rate how strongly they felt 10 specific positive emotions like interested, proud, enthusiastic, inspired, really happy things. And then they also tracked their physical activity, their sleep, their heart medications, their smoking, and other levels of stress.
Christy, I have heard you talk to our residents, and I would say you are interested, proud, enthusiastic, inspired. You got a lot of those positive emotions. Physically, I know you're pretty active. Sleep quality, I don't know about. Medication, I bet you do a good job. Alcohol and cigarettes, I know I don't have to worry about that. So I would imagine you would score pretty darn high on this positive emotions.
I hope so. And I would say the same about you. The good news is that the patients who reported these higher positive emotional states were more likely to be physically active, which we want people who have heart disease to be physically active. They were more likely to sleep better. They were more likely to take their heart medications. And they were less likely to smoke compared with the people who had lower levels of these positive states.
Yeah, I think this is not a cause and effect. We don't say, oh, if you start having positive emotions and you do any of these other things here and you weren't physically active that you get these benefits. But if it's half empty or half full, I think let's take the half-full approach here, and it's a win-win.
Yeah, let's go for it. I wish we could sing that because I'm happy. Do you know that song?
I don't, but I like it. We'll teach it to me.
We'll play it. I'll have to teach it to you
after. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We've had a good chance to talk about positive emotions.
We've talked about research suggesting people with a family history of colon cancer should get their colonoscopy sooner.
If you're aware or you're experiencing depression in the workplace or even outside of it, please do get treatment.
And that smoking and heavy alcohol use are associated with these epigenetic or gene marker signs of aging.
So we're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Christopher Robertson, Associate Professor at the University of Arizona's Rogers School of Law, about prescription drug ads, the Food and Drug Administration, and informing your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. You UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Christopher Robertson, Associate Professor at the University of Arizona's Rogers School of Law, about a recent New England Journal of Medicine perspective article he wrote on prescription drug ads, the Food and Drug Administration, and informing your health.
Welcome, Dr. Robertson. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Christy and Adam. It's great to be here.
Now, you study how the law can improve healthcare and health communication. How did you get started on that path in your career?
You know, I started out really as a philosopher. I did a PhD in philosophy and then moved from there into bioethics. And so in that field, we're studying end-of-life care and organ transplantation, euthanasia, and all these really tough questions from a philosophical perspective. But I found that really the most interesting part is that they were all mediated by individual choices, doctors and patients making, you know, these huge, tragic decisions for themselves. And so when you think about the quality of those choices, that's what really drives me to think about the information people have, the values that they rely on, and the communication between the patient and their physician in that relationship. So I think those are what really drive the choices we make and the healthcare outcomes that we experience.
You know, you sound like you could have been a family doctor
if
you went to medical school. I mean, you got all those values and beliefs, and it's the sort of thing we, as Christy and I, as practicing family doctors, know our patients want and we want in healthcare. So what goes wrong? in your world, in the legal world, the things you study, where do the problems lie?
Well, really, we've learned a lot as law professors. We've learned a lot from economists, to be honest. And we see that a lot of things go wrong when financial influences point people in the wrong directions. We create incentives that don't necessarily lead to good health as the ultimate goal.
Like what?
So a lot of my work relates to the healthcare industry and the relationships, for example, that they create with physicians by paying physicians on the side for, say, consulting or for running clinical trials. And we worry about how that can, for example, impact physician decision-making. On the other hand, we also look at how the healthcare industry can affect patient decision-making through consumer marketing, the sorts of ads we see on TV and in our newspapers.
And, you know, thinking about our listeners, they most likely see direct-to-consumer advertising when you're thinking about the drug companies selling it and advertising directly to the consumers, the patients, for prescriptions drugs. And most people see these commercials, the Cialis commercial, all these different sort of famous commercials, and don't really think a whole lot about it. But it's relatively unique in our country that people can, that the drug companies can market directly to patients. Is that correct?
That's right. There's only 2 countries on the face of the earth where the governments allow drug companies to advertise directly to consumers.
Us and who else?
New Zealand, in fact.
New Zealand. Interesting.
Our brethren from around the world. For our listeners in New Zealand, they probably knew that. But
Exactly. But all the countries in between do not.
So why is that? Why? And I know this isn't a... This hasn't been going on for forever. This is a more recent phenomenon where direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription drugs is more recent.
Right. The whole concept of a prescription drug is, of course, that a patient can't simply go buy it over the counter. The prescription drug is supposed to be, you know, that ultimate decision made by a trained physician who can weigh the risks and the benefits of the drug. And so most other countries conceive, well, in this domain, then, really, drug companies have no business marketing directly to consumers, since really this is the sort of thing that needs to be driven by our physicians as our advisors and our protectors of our good health. We're sort of unique here in the United States, on the other hand, because we have a very robust, what I would call a consumerist culture, the idea that the patient is a consumer that can make her own decisions. And we also have a First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that protects the rights of freedom of speech. And we know the Supreme Court has, over decades, interpreted that right to apply to companies, just as it does apply to someone running for political office. And so that right has been interpreted to give corporations like Pfizer or AstraZeneca the right to speak to consumers directly and tell them about their product. So those two trends in the United States, a consumerist culture and a First Amendment to the Constitution, have made us relatively unique globally in this domain that's otherwise thought to be the business of a physician.
The other question I have is what kind of rules are there about what the drug companies can do on these commercials? I'm just thinking about some of these commercials. It's like some beautiful woman jogging and some arthritis medicine or something. And you just look at that and think, I want to be just like her. And so that's sending one message. And then it goes through like this long list of awful kinds of potential side effects that people just sort of ignore. And I wonder, like, what is required? Why then do they list all those things? What are we actually communicating to people?
Right. So the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, does regulate these advertisements. And the most fundamental principle is just that they can't be false or misleading. They can't claim an efficacy or a safety that hasn't been proven to the FDA. And going along with that, then, they're not allowed to promote for indications or uses that the FDA hasn't approved. So every drug that's on the market has been approved for at least one specific use. And physicians can actually prescribe drugs for other uses, but companies aren't typically allowed to market for those other uses. So that's the very fundamental level of regulation. Beyond that, then, there are more specific regulations that require that companies give sort of a balanced portrayal of the risks and benefits of a product. Now, in practice, that does mean the company can promote the benefits of the product, but usually in very compelling ways, you know, with music and actors and actresses and the whole comedy. To portray a drug as being helpful and beneficial, and then often there'll be a list of side effects or warnings, you know, in the fine print or uttered relatively quickly at the end. And typically the FDA has also required companies to accompany a TV advertisement with something in writing, a written advertisement in a magazine or something that can give more detail about these risks or side effects of a drug.
So it seems that there are two issues that I'm just thinking of right at the top of my head, which, or three. One is that, you know, when Christy and I are having conversations with patients about drugs in our office, and, you know, we want to talk about the benefits and we want to talk about the side effects. Well, the side effects, we know there are hundreds, if not thousands, for almost every single drug. And so we try to figure out in a very limited time frame, you know, which ones are important. And we also say the pharmacist will give you a drug information sheet about these. But there's no possible way in a TV ad, for instance, that the pharmaceutical company can cover these things. So does the Food and Drug Administration tell the pharmaceutical companies what they have to say that is the kind of the warning aspects, or do they leave that up to the pharmaceutical companies?
They have in the past been fairly specific about what needs to be included. And it needs to be basically the same things that the FDA has already reviewed for the packaging inserts or for the labels that actually go in the and on the product. And so traditionally the FDA said, just put it all in there, companies. More recently, in fact, just this year, the FDA has proposed a new rule that would allow companies to decide what risks are really sort of most important. And so it's actually going to give the companies more discretion in what to put on these advertising materials.
Well, this sparks a whole nother series of questions in my mind, but we do need to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue talking with our guest, Dr. Christopher Robertson, Associate Professor at the University of Arizona's Rogers School of Law, about prescription drug ads, the FDA, and informing your health. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Christopher Robertson, Associate Professor at the University of Arizona's Rogers School of Law, about prescription drug ads, the FDA, and informing your health. And before the break, Dr. Robertson, we were talking about sort of this shift or this proposed shift where the Food and Drug Administration or the FDA would allow the drug companies to decide what side effects they list in their commercials and marketing things. I also wonder to what degree the companies feel they have to list as many side effects as possible or have to list the scariest ones to prevent a lawsuit. Like, how does that play?
Well, in fact, in some areas of federal law has actually preempted state law, meaning that state law doesn't apply. But in this area, the Supreme Court has said that state laws, state tort laws, of which eventually a jury could impose liability on a company, still apply here. So even if the FDA gives companies this power, they could still be sued by an individual patient who later suffers a side effect that the company did not disclose in their marketing material. So this additional discretion given by the FDA may actually amount to nothing if companies are still worried about that state tort law. And I'm not necessarily saying whether that's a good or bad thing, but it will remain a worry for companies.
So it seems as if, and you argue in your article in the New England Journal of Medicine, that the fundamental thing that's at play here is to try to improve disclosure of information and to kind of take what you describe as an evidence-based approach. How does that work?
Well, what I would like to see is the FDA encourage companies to actually give meaningful information to consumers about both the risks and the benefits of drugs being marketed. Really, I think consumers, when they're considering a drug, especially the sorts that are advertised, we don't typically advertise chemotherapy drugs, for example. Instead, the things that are being advertised are often lifestyle diseases like drugs for diabetes management or hypertension or erectile dysfunction. And patients there are really interested in the effectiveness of those drugs. And unfortunately, a lot of the prior research shows that these new drugs are often no more effective than the cheaper ones that are already on generic or already at least on the market. And so I think one thing that companies could begin doing if the FDA made them is advertise the real efficacy information that shows whether they are any better than the prior drug. And I think then you might have consumers, being able to weigh them accordingly.
Would this be like the Rotten Tomatoes that we rate movies that would be for drugs? Is there some way to mobilize either physician opinion about the effectiveness or data? Because sometimes these studies are not done in the real world. They're done in laboratories. So how do we even know that what you find in one venue is going to work in another venue?
This raises much larger questions about how good is the scientific research that the FDA is relying on. And really, our disclosure system can only be as good as the underlying science, which you're suggesting, is often is not wonderful. I mean, these drugs are tested in real patients, but the problem is sometimes those patients are picked from populations that are less likely to suffer bad outcomes and more likely to suffer good outcomes. So the science itself can be sort of biased towards showing that a drug is safe and effective. So really, our disclosure system can't be any better than our underlying science, and we need much more pressure on the FDA to require companies to themselves press on companies to do better science.
Well, a lot of times within the science, there are a lot of nuances of where it really applied for this particular population of patients or these little specific parameters that the research showed the drug being helpful. But it's hard to communicate that in a short ad or commercial to a lay population who may not understand, you know, relative risk reduction and odds ratios and, you know, or specific populations and the principles of good research design. So that would pose challenges. How would you recommend overcoming some of that?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, we're still going to rely on physicians to make the final judgment about whether to write that prescription or not. And thank goodness, because of exactly those problems. Now, frankly, I worry that, although physicians are trained to understand, you know, risk ratios and things like you just mentioned, in fact, it takes a lot of work, and it's very difficult for physicians even to keep up with mm-hmm. the new science and these sorts of, and to second guess a study that may have been published in a great journal and to really get into the weeds of the methodological design. So I think for that purpose, we really need more, systematic reviews. We need scientists helping physicians make better decisions. And those sorts of decision aids, the very same ones that physicians can use, can be readapted and repurposed for patients to use as well. But ultimately, the function of advertising is to drive demand, is to cause patients to at least ask for a new prescription. And so we need to be able to again, empower physicians to answer their questions, to answer that demand intelligently.
You mentioned in your article that you could see one day perhaps a system of rating, perhaps for drugs. I don't know if it's for safety or effectiveness or a combination, but you said like an ABC system, almost perhaps like a grade of restaurants. No one wants to get that 75. A 75 grade in a restaurant is a kiss of death. That means there's cockroaches somewhere. Would you see the same sort of thing happening with these types of drugs so they'd have to communicate and you would at least know broadly what it means? Or is that what you're thinking or not?
Yes, we're actually already doing this. Scientists are already doing this when they look at new drugs coming out. They will rate them as to whether the new drug is a substantial breakthrough that's creating a new class of treatment or a new level of treatment that was previously unavailable. A drug like that can get an A. Whereas a lot of other drugs that are just sort of a marginal improvement, they're better than a placebo, but perhaps never even tested against the standard of care drug. A drug like that should really get a C or maybe a C plus. You know, sure, it seems to be safe, but we don't yet know much about it because it's new on the market, and it, so far it doesn't seem to be a huge breakthrough.
That would be
so
fantastic.
We already do that in the scientific literature. Some of that can really be boiled down, I think, and useful for patients too.
The other pressure that you alluded to earlier that's worth just mentioning briefly is the pressures on physicians if there are drug companies giving them free samples or free lunches or free things, and then how that trickles to the patients. I just had a relative who was on, you know, this high expensive bistolic beta blocker medication and was given mostly samples, but then sometimes had to pay $200 or $300 to get this medicine, which of course is, you know, less studied and not as proven for her situation than generic, you know, $10 medication. And, I had to really encourage her, go back to your doctor and say, is there a generic alternative? but how much that plays still in America is shocking to me.
Well, some of my other research published in the New England Journal of Medicine has looked at data about how many physicians are taking these payments. And in some specialties, it's over half of the physicians are taking money from the drug and device industry on the side. It depends on the state and depends on, you know, which specialty. But there's a very a large chance that any of your listeners' physicians are taking money. Sometimes it's for bona fide reasons. It's often for bona fide reasons. But you still have to worry about it sort of on the tipping point, maybe biasing your physician.
Well, it's just worth asking the question.
To ask, really, when a prescription is written, do you have a relationship with this company? Part of the Affordable Care Act included something called the Sunshine Act. This is Obamacare. It has a part called the Sunshine Act, where you can actually now go look up on a federal website, cms.gov/openpayments, to see if your doctors are taking money on the side, and encourage listeners to do that.
Yeah, I don't think there is such a thing as a free lunch.
There is no free lunch.
We published an article years ago. Well, you know, Dr. Robinson, I think we appreciate your time. We appreciate what you're doing. Is there one single piece of advice you'd like to leave our listeners with on how they can get the best information on prescription drugs?
You know, I think there's no substitute for being a thoughtful and careful patient that asks tough questions of their physician. You know, sometimes we feel rushed when we're in that doctor-patient relationship, but to slow down and really ask about these financial relationships, ask about the side effects, and do your own research. The physician's a partner, and those questions are essential.
That is really good advice. Thank you for the work that you're doing. We've been talking with Dr. Christopher Robertson, Associate Professor at the University of Arizona's Rogers School of Law, about prescription drug ads, the FDA, and informing your health. Very helpful, Dr. Robertson. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call today.
My fiancé wants to get a cat, but I'm allergic. It's not a super serious allergy, but my eyes get itchy and I get a runny nose and sinus congestion when I pet cats or I'm in a room with lots of cat hair for a little while. I can usually deal with the symptoms with medicine, but I would rather not have to be constantly taking antihistamines for however many years we have the cat. Are allergy shots a good option for me?
Well, they could be. I mean, they're a good option for a lot of people, but it's not so straightforward, and we probably have several questions we want to ask.
Right. I mean, the one question when you say you can handle it for a little while, but you can't be in a room where there's lots of cat hair. And if you have a cat in the house, depending on what kind of cat you get, there's probably going to be a lot. There's going to be cat hair around. And
right. You got to
live there.
You may have
it's
to
not
get rid
just
of the
for
cat.
A little while.
The,
right.
The allergy shots would probably help if you had allergies to lots of things and it might benefit. And most people wouldn't be just allergic to cats. But for you, probably getting rid of that cat hair is a huge thing to do.
Right, right. So, I mean, this is a complicated thing. You wonder if you could take your antihistamine, especially if you take a non-sedating one like Zyrtec or Claritin that's 24-hour, and maybe have the cat in the home for a little while and see how that does before you commit to getting the cat. And you can pursue the allergy shots, but there's no guarantee that it's going to work well enough for you to be able to have a cat in your house.
Are there certain cats that are less allergenic than others? Like kind of, you know, there's certain dogs, the short-haired dogs or dogs that don't shed?
I think there are, but I don't know. I mean, there are those like sort of almost bald-looking cats that
I think, you know, if we have a listener out there that is an expert on allergies and cats, certainly let us know and send to us a note. This is one of those things that, you know, we do know that getting rid of the exposure really does help here. And you certainly could take these other treatments, but, you know, this is a uphill climb.
Right, right, to invite it. But work with your fiance and with your doctor on it, and maybe there's some sort of a compromise. Okay, let's take our next House Call question.
I recently found a tick on my 6-year-old daughter. I was able to remove it, and I didn't notice a rash, and my daughter appears to be fine, but I'm worried about tick-borne diseases, as I don't know how long the tick was on her. Should I take her to the doctor, or is there something I should wait to see for first?
You know, this is a common question, especially in North Carolina. If you're a listener around here, tick-borne illness can be very significant. But most ticks don't carry tick-borne illness, so that's the good news. And if there's no rash and she's fine, what I tell people is to mark the calendar. And if there's any, like, significant fever, headache, neck stiffness, that comes in the following 3 weeks, that would be a reason to go take her in and see the doctor. But not everybody. And it's tricky with kids, too, because the medicine that we sometimes give people at the beginning can stain their teeth, although you have to get a bunch of doses to stain their teeth. So it's a complicated little question. But you can't give medication every single time you see a tick.
But you could put that little tick in a little jar or a little baggie or a little sort of container so that in case something happens, you can actually take that tick in and it perhaps can be identified. So that might be helpful because there are a couple different types of ticks that can cause diseases. But I agree fully, Christy. A lot of reassurance goes a long way in this particular circumstance because if we were to say to have everyone with a tick bite come in and see the doctor, I think we'd be inundated.
I think we would too, although sometimes people come in and I can look at it and it's been a couple days and they're okay. And I just say, mark that calendar. And if anything happens in the next few weeks, come on back in, especially if you have fever.
Do you have anyone come in and say, I want you to look at this new little bump I've got on my skin? And you take a look at that little bump and you go, that bump's moving. And it's that tick that's still
that's
there.
It's right under there. Yep. I've had that before too.
Okay. We want those out.
Yeah, we do.
Tanya, what's our very last house call?
I'm a 55-year-old male and I'm in pretty good health. I'm not overweight, I eat pretty well, don't smoke, and get plenty of exercise. I have a wellness exam coming up and I want to make sure I'm getting all the right tests done and I'm doing all the preventive stuff. What sorts of things should I make sure to ask my doctor about?
Well, this is kind of near and dear to me, Christy. It's not me, but it could be me.
Be
I probably
you.
Need to schedule that wellness visit. It's been a little while, but I'm feeling pretty darn good.
So what kinds of things? I mean, the other thing I just want to compliment you on, the listener who's writing, is that you're preparing for that wellness visit. Like, it's so important to prepare for your doctor visits. So make that list of things to ask about so you don't forget, and just also so you can be a partner with your doctor in your healthcare. Okay, Adam, so what kinds of things are you going to put on your list before you make your wellness visit?
Well, I'm going to certainly put on there, have I had my colon cancer, like we talked earlier in the show? Have I had my colon cancer screening, and do I need to have it again, and when do I need to have it again?
Uh-huh. You're going to put on, have you had your cholesterol and diabetes screening, particularly if you're overweight? And at 55, if you hadn't had it before, you need to have that checked.
Yeah, I'll probably say, are there any shots I need to have, including a second shot for pneumonia, though I may not actually need one at this age, but I might want my flu shot, or I certainly may be indicated to have the shingles shot. I'd have that conversation with my doctor.
Mm-hmm. And you could need your tetanus pertussis, your Tdap booster, which is another immunization, depending on when your last tetanus was.
Most men will probably get a prostate examination, at least a digital examination, but whether that has benefit or not is really a little controversial. But, again, it's something to at least talk to your doctor about and see what the thoughts are on that.
And you want to make sure you're being fully honest with your doctor about, are you exercising? Are you smoking? Do you have, are you drinking? How much alcohol are you drinking? Just be prepared to be fully honest with your doctor about those things so that you can get really sound advice about how to keep yourself healthy.
I've got some family history of skin cancer. I'd like them to take a look at my full skin because I want to really make sure nothing's changing.
Yep, that's a good idea.
And, and myself, just being physically active, how much physically active are you? And can you be and get more exercise? I'm going to be doing this like mega exercise soon.
Yeah, tell us. You're going on a bike trip.
Yeah, I'm going to be going back for the third year in a row, Christy, to Israel. I'll be going a day or two after we in the coming week and be able to work for an organization that's trying to produce peace in the Middle East by bringing together Palestinian, Arab, and Jewish youth to really work on environmental research projects because the environment doesn't know boundaries. And you got to cooperatively solve problems around water and wind and food. And hopefully these are the future leaders of the region. And together, if they cooperatively work on the environment, perhaps they can cooperatively work on other issues. So I'd be biking 400 miles from Jerusalem down to Eilat, trying to promote the organizations that are working on this good thing without politics.
Fantastic. Well, we're proud of you for doing something so meaningful and also for being so physically active.
Maybe, when I come back, I'll get that wellness visit.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, everyone, for your questions. Thank you for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to your health. We want you to share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, on iTunes. You can get our health app by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Dr. Christopher Robertson. We hope you join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.